Welcome back to Series 3, Episode 9, and Part 2 of the Air France 447 accident. My name is Grant, and with me is James and Dave. And we're assuming you would have listened to the previous episode, Part 1 of this Air France 447. So let's continue and get into Part 2.
In the last episode, we discussed how only assumptions had been made into why Air France 447 crashed into the Atlantic. The accident investigators had debris and some basic data to go on, and thus were able to issue two interim reports. But they still needed the cockpit and flight data recorder to fill in the gaps, and also understand how the aircraft ended up where it did.
So luckily, just after 22 months, they found the wreckage on the ocean floor, which included the flight data and cockpit voice recorders. And work began on the 22nd of April 2011 to recover these two devices.
Both recorders were recovered within a day of one another. Work on the readout of the recorders began on the 13th of May. Miraculously, all 1,300 parameters from the flight data recorder were available by the 14th of May. A full and successful readout of the cockpit voice recorders was also carried out on the 15th of May.
Now, the final pieces of the puzzle and questions that remained unanswered for nearly 2 years were about to come together with the details of the flight data and cockpit voice recorders filling in the blanks.
The recordings were interpreted around the 29th of July 2011, and a third interim report was issued. It painted a picture of the lead up to the accident and made some further safety recommendations. The final report for the Air France 447 flight was issued on the 27th of July 2012.
So let's chat about the recordings. From when the first problem starts, we'll call that time zero, and we'll use like a stopwatch from when that point started and see what happens as the problems evolved. But in discussing what is about to happen and to help us comprehend what's going on, we need to understand a few fundamental elements of aerodynamics, which will in turn help us appreciate what led us to this tragedy.
This first point is regarding where the nose of the aircraft is pointing relative to where the aircraft is actually going. In Series 1, Episodes 3 and 4, we talk about lift and the basic forces involved in flight. Let us do a quick recap of the terms attitude, angle of attack, and stall.
Okay, so let's get into that then, James. So an aircraft is sitting on the runway, getting ready for takeoff. The aircraft attitude is level in that the nose is pointing at the horizon. Now, as it races down the runway, it needs speed as the wings need to generate lift. The more speed, the more lift a wing can produce. But clearly, there is a minimum speed that a wing needs in order to generate lift to counter the weight of the aircraft. So as the aircraft approaches that speed, the pilots pitch the nose of the aircraft up using the elevator. This pushes the tail down and in turn points the nose up. So on the 777, and most jets are the same, we rotate the aircraft to around about 15 degrees nose up. So 15 degrees is the nose up attitude of the aircraft. This, however, doesn't mean that the aircraft now climbs away from the airport at the same angle which it is pointing, in this case 15 degrees. It's about half that. So what has happened? Just say three quarters of the way down the runway on my takeoff roll, so before our calculated airspeed to take off, I decide to pull back on the control column and rotate that nose up to the takeoff position of 15 degrees. My nose would come up, probably quite slowly, but the main landing gear would still be on the ground as there would be not enough airflow over the wing to lift the aircraft. So the aircraft's direction would still be going along the runway despite the nose of the aircraft pointing at 15 degrees nose up. So in this case, the angle between the direction the nose is pointing, its attitude, and the direction the plane is actually going, which is along the runway, would be called angle of attack. And in this particular case of a very early attempt to climb, our angle of attack would be 15 degrees. In reality, the if they would be breaking away off the top of the wing, causing a lot of turbulence and drag. And this is precisely what happened at episode one of the series that we did on the first takeoffs of the Comets. So back to our normal takeoff. Now I'm taking off at the correct speed. The attitude is 15 degrees nose up, and the oncoming FO is about 8 degrees. So we're climbing away from the airport at about an angle of 7 degrees. And it is this angle between the attitude of the nose and the oncoming relative airflow that we term angle of attack. Dave, do you want to have a go at talking about lift?
Sure. Okay, well, with lift, there's two fundamental components of the lift formula, which is speed and angle of attack. If you want to maintain level flight and you also want to slow down, you need to increase the angle of attack and vice versa. Next time you watch a passenger jet coming into land in the later stages of the approach, check out what the attitude is. You will likely note that the airplane's nose, its attitude, is pointing up a few degrees above the horizon, but the aircraft is actually descending on a path that's 3 degrees to the horizon. So on approach, say 2 degrees nose up attitude and making a standard 3 degree glide path to the runway, the aircraft's angle of attack to the oncoming airflow would be about 5 degrees.
Yep, that sounds good. And to finish up, let's talk about the stall. Once you increase the angle of attack too much, the airflow simply breaks away from the top of the wing and it gets really turbulent. And this causes a huge loss of lift, and it's known as the stall. Now, the stall angle is affected by parameters such as speed of the aircraft, the altitude, and whether the flaps or slats are extended, to name a few. But generally, most clean wings, when I refer to a clean wing, that means the flaps and the slats are not out, they're in the up position, it'll stall around 15 to 18 degrees angle of attack. But speed is important, and for a given angle of attack, as you reduce the speed, then eventually that smooth air breaks away from the wing's top surface and your wing is then in a stalled condition.
So just to summarize, I guess, what we've said there, the attitude of the aircraft is the direction the nose is pointing up or down. Angle of attack is the difference between the aircraft's attitude and the oncoming airflow. And the stall is when the airflow over the wing stops being nice and smooth and breaks away, leading to a loss of lift.
Yep, that's right. Now, to go one step further to help you appreciate the attitude and angles of attack we fly at in the cruise, especially at high altitude in most modern jet aircraft, I've done some figures, and Dave, your figures are probably would be similar. If I'm, say, flying at 32,000 feet, my pitch attitude is 2.5 degrees up and my direction of flight is level. So that is an angle of attack of 2.5 degrees. If I want to do a climb to 34,000 feet, so a climb of 2,000 feet, I only pitch up a little bit, roughly about another 2.5 degrees. So my attitude is 5 degrees nose up. I put in full power and up we go. Now for descent, I took notes on a flight recently. Engines at idle, 0 degrees pitch attitude. So the aircraft nose was pointing directly at the horizon. My angle of descent was around 2.6 degrees, which was also the angle of attack. And I got a descent rate of around 2,000 feet per minute. So at altitude, the aircraft is very sensitive. Changes in attitude you would use to climb or descent are very small throughout all regimes of flight. And the only time, and I really need to stress this, the only time we use a high attitude is on takeoff, and that's because we have the flaps and slats out, which all contribute to lift. And the other time that we'd use a high attitude would be if we got a terrain warning and we're required to pitch the nose up to 20 degrees straight away and put full power on. Do you want to add anything to this, Dave?
I think you've covered it well. I would just add that an understanding or awareness that up at these high altitudes that we're going to be talking about where Air France 447 encountered their problems, the air is very, very thin up there. And rather than being down at sea level, we have a nice thick air, which allows the wings and the engines to work very effectively. Up at altitude in such thin air, the wings are struggling to produce lift, the engines are struggling to produce thrust. And as pilots, we have to be especially careful up at these high altitudes. And it's very, very rare that we actually are doing any hand flying up there in those thin air conditions at altitude. The autopilot is on pretty much 100% of the time, unless something is going wrong. And with Airbus, the protections that we have in the flight control systems are all designed around helping to protect us up in that thin air.
Yeah, you are right. I don't think I've ever gone above 5 degrees nose up attitude at high altitude. And that's just generally a climb and or zero for a descent. It's a very small regime we fly at.
So the other thing that I would add about the high altitude flight regime is that we very rarely practice any sort of high altitude flying. The simulator can simulate those conditions, and we can do some training in the simulator to replicate the conditions that we find. But if you spend so many hours flying an airplane where everything is going well, when something goes wrong, it's very difficult to find the answers outside of your knowledge area where you're normally operating an airplane. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you are right. High altitude flying, we kind of take it for granted. That's where we spend most of our flying, but the parameters in which we're flying are very tight as such.
There we have some context on these aerodynamic terms and the subtleness and sensitivity of the attitude of the aircraft in high-level flight. So coming back to Air France 447, let's see what the flight data and cockpit voice recorders told us was happening.
So at 0125 UTC, so nearly 3 hours after getting airborne, and it's nighttime, the captain was pilot monitoring, and he was sitting in his left-hand seat. And in the right seat was the co-pilot who was flying this particular sector. The co-pilot said there was something on the radar ahead which would have likely been regarding weather. And they discussed climbing to 37,000 feet, but they were too heavy, so they would remain at their current cruising altitude of 35,000 feet.
At 0145 UTC, they entered slight turbulence and were entering the tops of the clouds.
Then 7 minutes later at 0152 UTC, the turbulence stopped and the captain made a call to the second co-pilot, who was the augmenting co-pilot, to return to the flight deck as the captain was now going to take his rest.
At 0200 UTC, the captain left his seat and was replaced by the augmenting co-pilot. The augmenting co-pilot would sit in the captain's seat and he would take on the role of pilot monitoring. The captain listened to the brief between the two co-pilots and then left the cockpit to go for his rest.
So to set the scene now, the co-pilot was pilot flying, sitting in the right-hand seat. He had a total flying experience of 2,936 hours, of which 807 of those hours were flying the Airbus A330. And for the sake of the following discussion, we will call the co-pilot in the right seat pilot flying.
One thing I thought about this bit is CM2 had very limited experience. Even though we sort of say, oh, this is an everyday occurrence, the reality is PFCM2 actually didn't have very much experience going through that.
Yeah, I agree. The augmenting co-pilot was now sitting in the captain's seat. He was a lot more experienced. And his role as co-pilot in the captain's seat would be pilot monitoring. He had over twice the flying experience of the right seat guy. He had 6,547 hours, and most of those, three quarters nearly, were on the A330, being 4,479 hours. And we'll call the co-pilot in the left seat pilot monitoring from now.
6 minutes later, at 0206 UTC, the pilot flying spoke to the cabin crew and advised them of impending turbulence. They were then cruising at 35,000 feet, and the airspeed was around 280 knots, with a pitch attitude of around 2 degrees nose up.
At 0208 UTC, they turned left 12 degrees in order to avoid the worst of what was on their weather radar. They also reduced the speed and put the engine anti-ice on. It's normal procedure to reduce the speed to be at the turbulence penetration speed. You can think of this as a smoother ride for the aircraft and the passengers within it. They also put the engine anti-icing system on, as they were possibly in cloud, and this would stop ice forming on the engine intakes. Around this time, there was a crackling sound, which is assumed to be ice crystals hitting the cockpit windows.
So just after 2:10 UTC, the autopilot and auto thrust disconnected. And the pilot flying in the right seat immediately took direct control of the aircraft.
So the method of controlling the aircraft pitch and roll on the Airbus is a side stick. The right-hand seat pilot has one on the right side of where they're sitting, and the left seat pilot has one on the left side of where they are sitting. In this case, the co-pilot flying grabs a side stick to his right to manually control the aircraft. Neither of the pilots can see each other's side sticks or the inputs they're putting into them. So the autopilot and the autothrust have stopped working, and the pilot flying has grabbed his side stick to take control of the aircraft.
So now a bit of chaos and confusion begins. So this is where we'll start the stopwatch at 010 UTC. And it's the time when the autopilot and autothrust disconnected. Immediately, there was a stall warning.
Stall, stall. Stall, stall. Stall, stall.
On the pilot monitoring display, it's the guy on the left seat. The aircraft suddenly went from 275 to 60 knots. Then it happened on the standby instruments. As a result, the aircraft went from automated fly-by-wire normal computer law controlling the surfaces to alternate law.
Okay, so an alternate law on the 330, the controls are going to become a lot more sensitive. It's very easy to over-control the airplane. And remember, as we talked about before, the air is very thin up at this altitude. So you've got two things going on there, which as pilots, we would have to be particularly careful about. And also, as I mentioned before, as Airbus pilots, we spend almost 100% of our time. In fact, I would be prepared to almost guarantee those Air France pilots had only ever flown those airplanes in normal law. Now, suddenly, they're faced with a situation where they have a disconnection of the automation and a flight control system, which had reverted to alternate law, and it put them into a very unique and very sensitive situation.
3 seconds later, the pilot flying positions his side stick control back to pitch the aircraft nose up. The pitch attitude increases to 11 degrees and the vertical speed goes to 5,200 feet per minute.
Now, in order to climb at such a rate, one would need to trade off a lot of airspeed. So already there's a bit of confusion going on as to why you'd need to pitch the nose up, and this may have been instrumentation giving wrong information as to what was going on at the time.
At 7 seconds, the stall warning activates.
And at 12 seconds, the pilot monitoring from the captain's seat stated, "We've lost speeds, alternate law protections." The pilot flying then made some rapid and high amplitude roll control inputs, pretty much from one side to the other on his control stick.
Now, to put that last movement into context and to reiterate what Grant said earlier, we normally fly in the cruise at an attitude of around 2.5 degrees nose up. If we climb from, say, 35,000 to 37,000 feet, the pitch change will be at a maximum of around 3 degrees. So a pitch up of 11 degrees is way outside what we would normally expect in normal operations.
Yeah, then at 11 to 19 seconds, there were numerous messages on the ECAM system. Now, Dave, talk about this ECAM because I've seen some of the messages and that must have been really confusing.
Yeah, so ECAM stands for the Electronic Centralized Aircraft Monitor System. So essentially, and we talked about the early days, the early design of Airbus and using innovation. In the early aircraft design, there were three crew in the flight deck, as we mentioned before, so a captain, a first officer, and a flight engineer. And Airbus decided that it could essentially replace the flight engineer's position by using the ECAM system. A flight engineer's job primarily was to monitor systems. So he would have a panel. He would sit at 90 degrees to the pilots who were facing forward. And on his panel, he would be looking at hydraulic systems, pressurization systems, electrical systems, and so on. So the Airbus Industries decided that they would do away with the flight engineer position. and centralize the monitoring of the systems through the ECAM system. So the ECAM is designed to alert pilots to problems with the systems of the airplane. The other thing that the ECAM does is it not only provides information to the pilots as to system failures, but it also helps with diagnosis, and it also runs non-normal checklists or displays non-normal checklists for the pilots then to follow.
So they received a lot of messages very quickly, didn't they, on this ECAM system?
They did. The ECAM system is pretty smart. What it does is it prioritizes. So one of the very first messages that popped up would have been that the autopilot has disconnected and that the auto thrust system is disconnected. So it's pretty quick to tell the pilots, hey, you're now flying this airplane.
Yeah. Let's continue there, James.
The pilot monitoring stated they were climbing and asked the pilot flying in the right seat to descend several times. So the pilot flying made several nose down inputs that resulted in a reduction of pitch attitude and a reduction in the rate of climb. They had reached an altitude of just over 37,500 feet, so 2,500 feet above what was their cruise altitude in around 30 seconds. But these were random movements, and for the majority of the time, the commands put on the side stick were to climb the aircraft.
So over the next few minutes, a multitude of chaotic indications would occur, each one causing more confusion as to what was going on. Sometimes the speed would show, and other times it wouldn't. Sometimes a stall warning would be going,
stall, 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 stall,
which would be telling the pilots the aircraft was stalling, and then other times that warning would stop. There was a continuous cricket noise going on as the aircraft's altitude had deviated from what it was supposed to be. So there was a heck of a lot going on, not only visually, but orally as well.
37 seconds since the chaos started, the speed indicator on the left side appeared valid again, but the standby speed indicators were still erroneous. This data on the left side indicated to the investigators that the aircraft had lost about 50 knots of airspeed since the autopilot had disconnected.
Yeah, and that was likely as a result of that initial rapid climb.
At 40 seconds, the pilot monitoring in the left seat tried calling the captain back. At this time, the pitch or attitude of the aircraft goes from 6 degrees nose up to 13 degrees nose up.
So now 51 seconds had gone by and the thrust levers had been in the climb position, but they were now placed in the toga position, which is the full power position. Am I right in that statement, Dave?
Yeah, that's correct. Although I would add that up at those high altitudes, that difference in moving the thrust levers from climb thrust to toga thrust essentially wouldn't make much difference to the amount of thrust that those engines were able to generate.
So the pilot flying now started making more nose-up inputs. The angle of attack at the start of this continuous stall warning that was going off was 6 degrees, but now the angle of attack then continued to increase. With these nose inputs, the trim system started to move from 3 degrees to 13 degrees nose up in 1 minute, and it stayed there for the remainder of the flight. Could you just explain the trim system briefly, please, Dave?
Yeah, so in other aircraft types, when a pilot makes an input onto the control column, say he wants to pitch the airplane up, rather than holding the control column back for the whole time he wants to climb, the pilot manually trims the stabilizer system. Well, on the Airbus, using, again, innovation, they decided that they could automate that. So rather than a pilot having to make an input on a trim switch, the airplane would just automatically trim. So as an Airbus pilot, we just set an attitude, and essentially we let go, and the airplane just automatically trims itself into position and will fly and maintain that pitch attitude.
So that trim system is a very powerful system.
It's very powerful, yes, and it's very useful in normal flight, in normal law, under normal circumstances.
Okay, let's carry on then.
Between 55 seconds to 1 minute and 30 seconds, the vertical speed would change from going up at just over 2,200 feet per minute to descending at 3,900 feet per minute. The aircraft had now reached a maximum altitude of 37,924 feet, so just short of 3,000 feet from its original cruise altitude.
Yeah, then at 1 minute 30 seconds to 1 minute 43 seconds, the vertical speed increased further to a descent rate of 6,800 feet per minute. The pilot flying was still holding a side stick back. He's asking the aircraft to climb, and at this stage, the aircraft nose was pointing at 16 degrees nose up. However, the angle of attack had now reached nearly 30 degrees, and the plane was descending rapidly.
Just to give a little bit of context to your listeners, when you're talking about those numbers of a rate of descent of 6,800 feet per minute, I don't think I've ever been in an airplane going down at 6,800 feet a minute. That's already an extremely high rate of descent.
Yeah, I agree with you. If we have a depressurization and we have to descend in a hurry with full speed brake and we go down on the limit of the aircraft speed, we'd be lucky to get 5,000 feet per minute.
For the listeners, what is the regular sort of descent rate when they're coming, you know, descending?
It starts off at altitude, about 2,000 feet per minute. It's around about descending to around about 800, 1,600 feet per minute.
That's why it's good to give a little bit of context, because it's a lot of numbers just to try to make sense in people's mind. So this is already extreme, and they're only, you know, a minute and a half into it.
Yeah.
Now, 1 minute and 43 seconds has gone by, and this continues through to 2 minutes and 22 seconds. The attitude goes from 14.8 degrees nose up to 9 degrees nose down, and then comes back to 0 degrees. The co-pilot side stick position goes to the full nose up position and will remain there for the next 52 seconds.
You kind of like sense just listening to that there. When the nose came down, have they kind of worked it out temporarily? And is there indications going on that the airspeed's now working or not working and causing more confusion as to where to point the nose? At 2 minutes and 46 seconds after the autopilot disconnected, the pilot monitoring the left-hand seat takes over the controls by stating, "controls to the left," and as a result, took over priority and he continued to handle the aircraft. The pilot flying in the right seat almost immediately took back priority without any call out and continued piloting the aircraft.
So now the pilot monitoring in the left seat was pushing his side stick forward to lower the aircraft nose attitude, whilst the pilot flying in the right seat was pulling his stick back to hold the nose up. The effect of this and alternate law was to cancel each other's inputs out. This triggered an audio dual input warning.
Dual input. Dual input.
Which no doubt would have been drowned out by all the other warnings going on. Yeah, I think it's useful at this stage just to have a think about what was going on the flight deck at the time. So yes, the pilots would have had some basic training in the handover, takeover of the side stick and the side stick logic, which is basically if a computer sends two inputs or dual inputs, it algebraically adds them together. So if somebody's pushing full forward and somebody's pulling full back, then the computer looks at that and does some maths and goes, okay, well, that's a zero input. So you have to be very clear with who's actually flying the airplane. So it needs to be stated. The takeover push button must be pushed to give you the priority. But the fact that all that wasn't done properly is just, I think, an indication that things were getting pretty chaotic in the flight deck. It was a dynamic, changing situation. It was unclear what the problem was. There was lots of noise going on. And to be honest, a pretty scary situation. I mean, it's dark. They can't see out the window. And there'd be a lot of noise coming in from the weather that they were in. And that's all just adding to the stress, the confusion, and the startle of what's going on. So just by looking at what's happening here with the crew, the effect, I think, of the startle of this event is that their brains effectively are not able to access all the useful parts that would help them recover from this. So it's gone basically into a, you know, a fight or flight type response. And there doesn't seem to be any ability to access, you know, training, logic, common sense, judgment, decision making, all those sort of useful parts of the brain, which the brain doesn't allow you access to when you're being startled. I think it's interesting that, you know, we could kind of look at this and go, well, why do they do that? And always with accidents, it's not about what happened, but why. I think you really have to put yourself in the seat and understand what it would have been like for these guys. This would have been pretty terrifying, to be honest.
Yeah. There was a lot going on here because remember the plane gave dodgy airspeed at the start. It just stopped the airspeed readings and now it seemed to be working again. And of course, with a very high angle of attack, the airflow doesn't go directly into the pedo. So the computer probably thinks, well, that airspeed's way too low, so I must be on the ground. So if I'm on the ground, I don't need to tell the guys there's stall warnings. We're all looking good. But once the nose came down a bit, airflow starts to go in, and now it's giving a correct airspeed, and the plane's going, hey, you're stalling. So by pitching the nose up, the airflow was at such an angle to the pedo probes, it wasn't working. The computers are probably saying, oh, we're on the ground, so we're not stalling. And it must have been hugely confusing.
Yeah, it's a very good point. And you could ask any Airbus pilot, I think, back in those days and said, any idea of the stall warning system when it stops working for you? And I think we were all really surprised after this accident happened and the report came out to learn that the engineers had designed a system that could end up being that confusing. So that's what we call a latent threat or a latent error, if you like, just sitting there waiting to catch somebody out. And it caught this crew out on that night. And to be honest, I'm not surprised. So they were given conflicting information. There was an error that they made by not turning off the flight director, for example. When the flight director did come back on, it engaged in a mode that was the complete opposite of what they needed to be seeing. But it gave them conflicting information that they should be pitching up towards what the flight director was saying, but they really needed to be doing the opposite. So sure, the crew made errors for sure, but you know, we can never get rid of human error in aviation, the flight deck. But it was compounded by and added to by the complexity of the systems.
So let's crack on. Where are we up to now? We're about 2 minutes or they've gone by.
So now after 2 minutes and 48 seconds had gone by, the captain arrived back into the cockpit and immediately asked, what are you doing? He would likely have sat on the jump seat between and behind both the co-pilots, and it must have looked like utter chaos to him. In the following seconds, all the recorded speeds became invalid and the stall warning stopped. That stall warning had been going for 54 seconds nonstop. The reason that the stall warning stopped was, as you mentioned, it was due to the fact that the angle of attack was so high, all the airspeed indications were now considered to be invalid by the computer. It's interesting that the captain came back and opted to sit behind the two pilots in the jump seat rather than swapping into the left-hand seat. And I think about that. I thought, what would I do if I was coming to the flight deck and had this situation? So, of course, hindsight's a wonderful thing. You could say, well, if he got into the left-hand seat and took control, then maybe he would have got the airplane out of the stall if he could identify it.
But that's it. Sometimes when you're sitting there, and you and I've seen this, sitting back in the augmenting seat watching a crew, you pick up little subtle things that they've missed and you kind of get a big picture because you're not focused on your task. If the captain got in the left seat, he might have just been as freaked out going, well, what the hell's going on here? I've thought about this as well. I think I would have sat there and just looked at, and I think that's what he was trying to do. What the hell is going on here?
That actually makes sense to me. So I would have done the same. I would have sat in the jump seat. These guys have been working with the problem. So they potentially have a much better understanding of it than somebody who's coming in cold as such and trying to get up to speed very quickly. So by sitting there and trying to build his situational awareness and his understanding of what's going on, by gathering information and keeping his workload low because he's not physically having to do any flying. So he's managing his workload. He's building a situational awareness so that he can start making some good decisions. So there's potential criticism for somebody not getting into the seat and trying to make the situation better. But I think by sitting back and observing and trying to go through the process of building up his awareness, like you, Grant. I think that was a reasonable thing to do.
That comment, he first says, "What are you doing?" He's just uttered, there's warnings, there's e-cams, there's speeds all over the place. It must have just looked like utter chaos.
Unfortunately for him, when he walked into the flight deck, the stall warning wasn't on. So if he'd walked in there and he'd heard stall, stall, he would have noticed that straight away. And that would have triggered in his mind, we've stalled. But because, as you mentioned, the stall warning had stopped, as he walked in, that stall warning was not going on. There was no initial big kind of audible hit to him saying, we're stalled. It was just bad luck. It was just bad timing.
So their altitude now, they were passing just over 35,000 feet. However, their angle of attack now exceeded 40 degrees, and their vertical speed had gone to 10,000 feet per minute in a descent. Now, the aircraft pitch attitude, it was pitched up. It did not exceed 15 degrees, and the engines, they were running at 100%. So this angle of attack of over 40 degrees would remain around this value for the rest of the flight.
The pilot flying in the right-hand seat stated, "We're losing control of the aeroplane," whilst the pilot monitoring in the left-hand seat then states, "We've lost all control of the aeroplane. We don't understand anything. We've tried everything."
So at this stage, the engines had been running at 100% nearly. Now, it's worth noting something here about the location of jet engines on a modern aircraft and how they can affect the pitching of an aircraft. And I'm sure the A330 is no different. Dave, how can power changes cause an aircraft to pitch up and down?
Well, if you look at modern jet aircraft side on, the majority have their engines slung under the wings. Now imagine a jet aircraft cruising along at level flight at low level with 50% power on the engines. If you apply full power and didn't move the controls, the underslung engines, being the lowest part of the aircraft, basically rotate the nose of the aircraft up. In other words, they increase the aircraft's attitude into a climbing position. And the reverse, if you move the engines to idle, it would then pitch down.
Yeah, and you can see at this stage, it wouldn't have been helpful at all, especially with that nose trimmed up as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, 2 minutes and 55 seconds after the autopilot had disconnected, the thrust levers were moved to idle. However, at 3 minutes, so just 5 seconds after the thrust levers were moved to idle, the stall warning triggered again. The vertical descent speed had reached 14,800 feet per minute, and within the next 5 seconds, that increased to 15,300 feet per minute.
Wow, it's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's huge if you think that when we're up at altitude around 30 plus thousand feet, if we do have a problem, we have this perception that we've got plenty of time to recover from this because we're way up at 30 plus thousand feet. But if you're going down at 15,000 feet a minute, you've really only got a couple of minutes to get this sorted out. Yeah. And I think that's a little bit of a misconception that when things are going wrong at altitude, you have time available to fix it. It's not necessarily going to be the case.
Yeah. So at 3 minutes and 8 seconds have gone by, the pilot flying stated they had no more displays. And the pilot not flying backed this up with a statement saying they had no valid indications. 9 seconds after the statement, the thrust levers are moved back to the climb position. So the engines were only at idle for 23 seconds. I wonder why they moved them back. I wonder if it's because with a stall, you think, oh, we're stalling, we're slow on speed, we need power to overcome the stall.
I don't know that they had that cognitive capability at that stage. I think they were just trying to do things to try to change what they had. I don't know that they were too aware of it at that stage.
From 3 minutes and 8 seconds until 3 minutes and 50 seconds, there were many random movements made on the sidestep, from nose down movements to nose up movements. The thrust levers were then moved from the climb position to the full power toga position during this time period.
At 3 minutes and 50 seconds, the captain says it's impossible. He's likely trying to understand what the problem is. I think it's also worth noting here that the original problem which the airplane had up at altitude had actually cleared, and this was now a perfectly serviceable airplane with all systems working, but just in a deep stall.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yep. So now, exactly 4 minutes after the autopilot had disconnected, the pilot monitoring in the left seat states, "You're going down." Then both he and the captain sitting behind them both call to get the wings level. There is more dual inputs as both pilots are putting commands into their respective side sticks. The aircraft is rolling left and right.
The captain's trying to make sense of what's going on. At 4 minutes and 22 seconds, the captain says, "What do you have?"
And at 4 minutes, 25 seconds, the pilot flying says, "There, we're passing level 100, which is 10,000 feet. More dual control inputs are occurring.
Then 4 minutes, 32 seconds have gone by. The pilot flying in says, "How come we're continuing to go down right now?"
And at 4 minutes and 46 seconds, the aircraft is rapidly passing 9,000 feet and the pilot monitoring in the left seat says, "Climb, climb, climb, climb."
Yeah, immediately the pilot flying the right seat responds, "But I've been at max nose up for a while."
The captain immediately replies to this saying, "No, no, no, don't climb."
Yeah, this is an interesting statement, and it does suggest or indicate that the captain has possibly worked out what the issue is, that he recognizes they are actually in a stall condition. But by this stage, it's too late. They are descending in a super stalled state. And to be able to recover from such a condition, off the top of my head, you'd need more than 20,000 feet of altitude to be able to recover the airplane from this condition.
Dave, from your experience flying the Airbus A330, from the jump seat, would the captain have been able to see the two pilots having the opposite sort of control inputs?
Yes, you could, because you're not fixed in position. You can, you know, you can lean forward, you can look around them, and you could see what they were doing if that's what you chose to do.
Can you, as a captain or the co-pilot, can you see each other's stick so you could look over where you're sitting and when you're flying and see what the guy's doing, or is it too dark, or is his body in the way?
Well, that's a good question about being too dark, but it's not a case of the body being in the way. So if you want to see what the other person is doing, the side stick, you just look across and you can see it. But, you know, generally speaking, we don't, because we're focused on either, you know, looking out a window or close to the ground, or looking at our instruments, and we're making sure the airplane is doing what we want it to do rather than focusing on what the guy's doing with his side stick.
Right. Now, at 5 minutes and 35 seconds after the problem first started, the aircraft impacted the sea with the engines at full power. The nose was pitched up at 16.2 degrees nose up. They had a forward speed of 123 miles per hour, or 198 kilometers an hour, and a vertical descent rate of 10,912 feet per minute. That would be the equivalent of descending at 123 miles an hour, or 200 kilometers per hour. And the forces involved in the aircraft hitting the sea were totally unsurvivable.
Yeah, and to just perhaps give that a bit of context, we're talking about the aircraft hitting the sea at 10,900 feet a minute. When we are approaching the runway to land, we're normally doing 700 feet a minute. And then the flare and touching down, we're doing pretty much 0 feet per minute. So, and a normal rate of descent, as we talked about before, is probably 1,500 feet a minute. So to be hitting the water at close to 11,000 feet per minute is just astronomical.
Now, with the flight data and cockpit voice recorders, a complete picture was able to be created, and the gaps were finally filled in as to how the aircraft ended up as it did. So what exactly was the cause of the accident?
So the French investigating authority, and hopefully I won't wreck this too much, the Bureau d'Enquête d'Analyse, or BEA for short, their final report concluded that
the aircraft suffered temporary inconsistencies between the airspeed measurements, which likely came about as ice crystals started obstructing the aircraft's pitot tubes, which in turn the autopilot to disconnect. The crew reacted incorrectly to the abnormality, causing the aircraft to enter an aerodynamic stall, which the pilot failed to correct.
The initial problem was the obstruction of the pitot tubes by ice crystals during the cruise. The pitot probes are the probes on the front of the fuselage that measure the aircraft's airspeed.
The startle factor and apparent difficulties of handling the aircraft at high altitudes led to over-controlling by the pilot flying.
Yeah, and from there, a diagnosis to what was happening was made very difficult due to the compounding issues that had arisen out of over-controlling the aircraft.
In essence, it was a stall that was not diagnosed until it was way too late from which to recover.
Once the angle of attack got too extreme, air could not properly enter the pitot probes, and thus the computers deemed that it was probably something like a landing mode or something like that, would be my guess.
The annoying fact about this ice crystal blocking up the pitot tubes was that it was a known problem with this particular type or brand of pitot. It had already happened 9 times in the preceding year on the Air France Airbus A330-A340 fleet. All occurrences occurred in the cruise between 31,000 and 38,000 feet.
Airbus had recommended replacing the troublesome pitot probes in September of 2007, but it was not mandated, and thus it meant changing to the newer, less troublesome pitot probes was at the discretion of the operator. Also, the experience levels of the crew, this does leave a bit of a question mark. What do you think of that, Dave?
Well, the fact that it was well known that you can't stall a 330 in normal law, but what is the fundamental limitation when operating outside normal law, and would a low-experienced pilot be able to comprehend this given the limited amount of training in alternate laws? Also, why wasn't the unreliable airspeed actions performed immediately the airspeed became unreliable?
It is also worth noting here that the investigators already had a good understanding of what went wrong by analysis of the transmitted random airspeeds back to the Air France maintenance facility and analysing the parts of the wreckage that were found floating in the following weeks of the accident.
The question remained, though, as to how they ended up in this condition, and the flight data and cockpit voice recorder was able to answer this, despite being immersed in water at 3,900 metres or just under 13,000 feet of seawater for 23 months.
So out of these reports came numerous recommendations. The first and second interim reports, with their associated recommendations, were interesting. Bear in mind that they had no FDR or CVR and no major wreckage apart from what they had recovered floating. The main recommendation of these two reports was to extend the flight data's transmission battery life from 30 to 90 days.
The interim report number 3 and the final report were made after the recovery of the flight data and cockpit voice recorders. They had numerous recommendations such as more training in manual handling the aircraft with emphasis on high altitude stall recognition and recovery. More appropriate recommendations on the use of relief captain and rest periods. They also recommended better ongoing training in simulators relating to startle events, and those were just naming a few of the recommendations.
Following the accident, there were more direct changes made, particularly to the pitot probes, which were replaced by models less susceptible to icing. Air France made big changes in their crew resource management process, and they did give a lot more focused training on the simulator surrounding high-level flight and stalling.
Airbus mandated the removal of the problematic pitot probes on the Airbus A330 and A340 fleets, and a new airworthiness directive issued by EASA in December of 2020 asked that the autopilot not be re-engaged until airspeeds return to a value associated with consistent flight for 30 seconds.
As an industry, we're actually really good at looking at incidents and accidents which happen and looking at changing procedures and techniques and pilot training in order to make sure that these things don't happen again. So in this case, the manufacturers, operators, pilot associations, and the authorities formed a working group and drafted an airplane upset recovery training aid guide with a view to optimizing both the theory or academic side and the practical training in upset recovery issues. There's been a lot of focus put into the airspeed unreliable checklist as well. And I can tell you, as an Airbus pilot, we now do a lot more of this type of training where they put us in the simulator, take the simulator up to altitude, and we turn everything off, put it into alternate law, the instructor will put the airplane into a really challenging position that we then have to recover from. And that sort of training that we get is a direct result of this Air France 447 crash. So it's the only positive thing which came out of it is we do it a lot better and we do it a lot safer and we have much more awareness than we ever had before.
Yeah, I agree with you. We do it as well, Dave, on the 777. And a lot of airlines and colleagues I've spoken to, Boeing operators, it's not just an Airbus thing. It could happen on a Boeing. And we also do a lot of the upset training recovery. And I must say, it's been excellent. I've not only enjoyed it, but it makes you realize how sensitive the aircraft is and also what you can do with the aircraft and where it should be pointing when things are going wrong. Some companies have also gone a step further, and on three crew operations, instead of having one captain and two first officers, they've got two captains and one first officer. So you always have a significant amount of more experience permanently in the cockpit all the time with two captains.
Yeah, I think that's an example of how not only the industry, but individual airlines look at what their policies and processes are and adjust as they see fit to minimize risk or certainly counterbalance risk. I think one thing I would also add is that, you know, these events never happen in isolation. We could think of it as an accident chain where there are a number of links in the development of this accident. So you could go back to design and you could look at, you know, ECAM systems and stall warning systems. You could look at the pitot probe system, which was prone to icing, which was a known problem, which wasn't given the urgency it needed to. So that airplane went flying with deficient probes. I believe that the airplane was actually scheduled to have those probes replaced once it had returned off flight 447. So that was, again, bad luck. And if it had happened a day or two earlier, that accident wouldn't have happened. But it's just an example of another link in this accident chain. So the crew were relatively inexperienced, and a 3,000-odd-hour pilot sitting in the right-hand seat is not particularly experienced, and he had very little time on the Airbus, and I'm sure very little time flying in anything other than normal law. Two first officers in the flight deck at a time when they're going through some severe weather. The pilot flying, not having had much experience in those weather conditions. Mm. And then it's just an example of how, you know, we could just focus on the errors that the pilot's made, and he pitched up when he shouldn't have, and he didn't apply the unreliable airspeed procedure. But the pilots are really at the final links in the chain. You know, they're the last chance for that accident chain to be broken. But the lack of training they had up at altitude, well, you have to look back at the organization they were working for and look at, you know, the training that they weren't given. There's so many facets to this accident. I think it's really important that we don't just look at the pilots and say, well, look, they made some critical errors. There's always a lot more going on behind the scenes than just pilot error.
Unfortunately, it's a tragedy. A lot of people lost their lives, but as a result, we all learn from it. Well, one hopes we learn from it, and we'll find out in the next episode that one particular airline didn't really learn from it. I dare say after all the training and what was learned about this, that had this crew been given the upset training and additional information put into the unreliable airspeeds, their first reaction would have been unreliable airspeed checklist, which is basically select a certain amount of power and put the nose roughly close to the horizon, hold it there, then work out what's going on. And following that event, as the de-icing would have occurred on the ice crystals would have disappeared from the pitot and everything came back, it would have returned to normal and they would have got control of the aircraft back quite quickly. But that's a function of what we learned after an accident, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're quite right. If that, those two things, if they'd had the high altitude stall or jet upset recovery and more focus on unreliable speed, I think, yep, if they called for that, if they just turned the automation off and just flown a pitch and a power, then pretty quickly the problem with the pitot system would have self-cleared and they would have regained a perfectly serviceable airplane. But that's the way that accident chain was built.
Yeah, very sad. So is there anything else you guys want to add to this?
No, I think that's probably it for Air France 447. The industry has obviously learned a valuable lesson. Unfortunately, however, not everyone, or at least every airline, took that lesson on board. And going into the next episode, we'll talk about two events with the Airbus A320 series, both of which had technical issues, both within 2 months of each other, and both were handled in completely different ways, the end result being extremely different in both those cases. That's in the next episode. From me, thank you for listening. It's been a pleasure. And thank you, Dave, for coming to this episode and helping us out a bit on the CRM side of things.
No, it was my pleasure. You know, it's a very interesting accident and it's well worth investigating and explaining it to people. So well done on choosing something that I think is really relevant to what we do.
Yep. Thank you very much for your input, Dave. Much appreciated. And from me, thank you everyone to your ears for listening and have a nice day.